What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Verzi Effect Podcast Show. I'm happy today. My name is Paul Verzi. You guys listened to episode 472, and my guest today is somebody, another guest that I'm going to probably make squeal at the beginning of this, because in my opinion, this man is an all-time great, and I've said this many times, one of the most underrated comedians of all time. And he's still known as an all-time great. The one and only Jim Norton is on the show. Jim, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah, and that does, it is any type of positive reinforcement, especially from like a friend and a peer, it makes me, I don't know how to handle it. Like, I'm comfortable with an intro that is more like, the next guy's been doing stand-up for 30 years. He's had some great moments, some not so great moments. Here's Jim. Like, I'm not good with compliments.
You know, it's so funny. As I was giving you that intro, I saw your eyes just go away and you just wanted it to be over. Why do you think we're like that? Why, if somebody's like, dude, killer set, or that's so funny, or I love it, why do you think we have the thing where it's just like, you know, there are some narcissistic assholes who are like, yeah, I know. But why do most of us not like it? Do you think it's a growing up thing?
I don't know. I think most of us are comedians because we have that. Like, the fact is, like, if I felt really great about myself and was like, yeah, thanks, I did do a great job, then I probably would have no need to do this. But it's right. Like, because it's always so, like, I remember as a kid getting a chopper. My parents bought me like a bicycle, and it had like a banana seat. It was kind of douchey, but all the kids in the neighborhood thought it was cool. And I remember being so ashamed that I had it, and so embarrassed, like I didn't deserve the gift. Like I don't know what it's from. I don't know. It's probably just the same thing that makes people go out and fucking hack up strangers. You know, it's a low self-esteem thing. With us, it comes out as jokes, and other guys pick up a rifle and shoot at people. You know, I think why we're comics.
I agree. I think that we definitely, I think it does come from, like, I don't know what your childhood was, but my parents had a brutal divorce when I was 5. My brother was 10. I had no security. And that's why we do what we do.
Right? Yeah.
And I'm glad that my kids are growing up normal and never going to fucking do this.
Yeah. It always comes from something weird. Like, you know, I think we were a little undisciplined too. Like, cause again, I'm from the 70s. So, you know, I mean, me and my friends were sexually active when I was a kid. Like, there's shit that you probably wouldn't do now that we did back then, because it was like very little parental supervision, at least in my life.
Were you a bad student, or were you a good student, like as academically?
Terrible. Because it was boring. You know how it is. I mean, I didn't enjoy it. It sucked.
Distracted. Yeah.
I was insecure. I felt ugly. I liked girls. They didn't like me, except when I was being funny. So you know how it is, man. It's the same story as every comic. I felt, but then again, some comics are like Geraldo, I think was a Harvard graduate. Like, so there are these, Dan Natterman, I think wanted to be a lawyer or was a lawyer. Like, so you have some very educated comedians too, but I was fucking awful. I dropped out of high school.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah. Senior year, which is what a dick. Who the fuck does that?
Yeah, you could have, like, I had friends that did it like early 10th grade. They're like, I just know this isn't for me. You were actually near the finish line.
Dude, I'm like fucking Richard Gere's friend in Officer and a Gentleman. You know, you DOR'd in the 14th week. I'm like, I was like that.
Dude, I don't know if you remember this. So you were at the Cellar. So years ago, dude, when I was like a couple years in, you would just go to the Cellar, and as a comic, you'd sit and watch. Like, this, like, you weren't even, you were just like, basically you were an audience member who's like did it a couple times. And I went in there, and you did something that none of the other comics did. I'm trying to think who was, I think it was
bombed.
Well, actually, it's funny you said that. You weren't bombing. You were just going dark. And when people didn't, and you just like looked at them and you go, you people need to be disciplined. And I remember you said that because you didn't like a reaction that you'd said something dark, and they kind of went back. And when you said you people need to be disciplined, and you stood there, that was kind of like one of the first times that I saw like a defiance in a comic that wasn't trying to get laughs or didn't care. And it was almost like, holy shit, like that dude is just, and it was like, cause you don't see that. Cause when you first get into comedy, you know, this, it's like, you got to get laughs, just laughs and this and that. And you want approval and you know, not pander, but you just want everybody. And you were like one of the first guys that were like, you need to be disciplined. And I was like, oh shit, he's just going, like, you just didn't care. It was almost like you were defiant that they didn't like the joke. As a first, I saw that.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. The Cellar, too, people, especially at the Cellar, because Esty, you know, everybody wants Esty to pass them. So when you first get in there, when you first start going in there, the instinct is you want to just kill. Like, and I was like that for years at the Cellar. But once you're comfortable there, you know how it is, man. You start to get annoyed that certain jokes don't work. Like, when a joke sucks and I know it's because of me, like, you know when it's you.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you'll do one and you're like, oh, fuck, that was them. That was them. They're just like, oh, and when they do that, you're like, you know, there's no way we're all going to feel like we need a shower when this is over. Like, like you're ruining my night. So I'm going to fucking go out of my way to wreck yours too, because I don't like that you're groaning. That's kind of probably what it was.
That's so true. Let me ask you this question, because I know you must feel this way. Do you ever feel that, like, when you're on stage and you're about to go into a joke, in your mind, Jim, you're going, ugh, why am I doing this joke? And I either know what it's going to do and I don't want to be doing it anymore. And I realize somebody's like, that's a growth spurt. Because you're just kind of, at that point, you're like, no, you go on to something else or talk more about something else that you want to talk about instead of doing this. Did you go through that?
All the time. And that's how I know it's time to move on. Like, what I do, it sucks when you're in the middle of a tour and like you're shooting at the end of the tour and you're like, it becomes autopilot. Like almost like, and I Louis C.K., he's so good at describing these basic things. Yeah. And I think his description of it was something about it becomes one task. Instead of a bunch of thoughts being put together as you're going, it's just one thing that comes out. And so it feels like automatic and not fresh. His description was much better than mine, but it made sense when he said it. So what I'll do to avoid that is I start doing my act, like I'll do it in reverse, or I'll start with not necessarily the closing bit, but the almost closing bit, and work my way backwards. So I have to think about what I'm saying. And that kind of jars everything loose, because your segues aren't automatic. You're not just going, it's like, if you have to recite song lyrics backwards, you probably have to think of each one.
Yeah.
So I start reversing my bit order, and that kind of shakes me out of that. But yeah, I do that all the time. It fucking, because each joke, instead of this fresh thing, is a fucking, like a fucking task, a finished task. And it feels dull and the audience hates it.
And it's funny, because we could go on stage for 45 minutes to an hour, but all we care about when we go home is those two or three new ones, right? That's all that matters.
Yes. And I'll open with the new stuff. I always try to open with it. Like, the way I work is I'll go on at the Cellar and I work out. And when I have a new 15, because it's almost like you're squeezing your toothpaste it out the back. And then I'll just go on and start opening with new shit and then continue from there until I have a new 45. That's kind of how I try to do it. But yeah, I get fucking bored immediately. I get so sick of my act.
Do you, I know people listening to this, cause you know, we haven't done this, and I wanted to ask you too, out of all the stuff that you did, the special, how many specials total?
Five hours and a couple of, shorter.
Do you have a favorite of your own? Like, is there one where you were just like, that night was how I wanted to do it, the best way I could do it? Or do you like love them all? Like are they like your children where you love them all the same? But, or is there one that you were like, that was the one?
No, I think the one I like the best for an hour, the more recent ones I like better, because I think I'm better than I used to be. Like, I like myself better on stage. I'm less animated. It's because you're just I'm a better comic than I used to be. So I would say that Mouthful of Shame is probably my favorite. I did the season 2 Degenerates. I liked my set on that a lot. But that was 20 to 25 minute set. But I like that a lot. So my two most recent are the ones I feel best about. I hate some of the earlier ones. you know, you're like watching yourself. You're like, oh, you mugging fucking zilch. Oh. You know, like, I hate myself in like the 2005 half hour I did for HBO. Oh, I was fat and I'm just like, it's unwatchable. Some of the jokes were pretty good though. Like, I look back and look at the joke quality. Yeah. It's me I hate. Like, I don't, the writing, I'm like, yeah, that was pretty good joke. But the me, it's the part, if anybody else was saying it, I'd probably be enjoying it. But the fact that it's me and I fucking looking at my face and I'm like, oh, you fuck.
Oh, you know,
so annoyed.
And when your neck is fatter, see, the thing is, I don't know if your weight, because I know you lost a lot of weight, but with me, it's all here. And here, so if my fucking jowls and neck are just, and you just look at yourself, you can't even listen to the joke, man. You're just so down on your, you. How much weight did you lose from your fattest?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, at one point, like I'm heavier now than I have been in a long time because of the pandemic, but I know what it is. Yeah. But at one point I was 136. And that was, I was horribly depressed and like just doing elliptical every day and not eating. And I look back at those photos and I could wear any clothes I wanted. Like a lot of it I did because I wanted to buy old Rock t-shirts. Like I'm such a mental patient. I wanted to go buy like old fucking like Sabbath and Kiss tour shirts. And back in the 70s, those mediums, you had to be like a fucking, you know, you had to be a twink to fit into a large. Yeah. So I was trying to lose weight. I could fit into these. But I got so fucking skinny. A while I was obsessed with staying under 140, but now I'm way heavier than that. But I look unhealthy. When I look back, SD, everybody used to tell me, put weight on, you look sick. And now I look back and I have enough distance and I'm like, yeah, he, like I have that, like that, like that sick smile. You know, the sick smile that a sick boy has.
Yeah. Yeah,
you you know, that's how I looked. Like I was a sick boy. I didn't look healthy.
You were definitely obsessed because I remember when I did the show, I think I did the show when it was you and Opie the first time I did it.
Yeah.
And you were like, it was like done. And you were just like, I got like, you were running to the gym. Like it was I remember. And it was just like, and I was like, is Jim like, all right. Like, you know, and they were like, no, he was just like, you got obsessed with it.
Yeah, I would go to the gym. I mean, I still go like 3 or 4 days a week, but the obsession is not there anymore. Cause I'm like, oh, I mean, everyone's been lazy for 8 months, but I got like really, but I was unhappy too. I wasn't like fucking feeling great about myself. You know, I mean, I was edging all day in front of the computer. It was awful. It was just like this, I would go home after work, after the gym and just do nothing all day. It was crazy. So yeah, I was miserable and depressed.
Was radio part of your, did you ever think when you got into stand-up that you were going to be on the radio?
No, never an intention. I fell into it, got lucky, and started going on ONA in 2000. And I kind of went full-time, I think sometime in 2001, and we got fired of August of 2002. So, you know, 2001 is when I really started like full-time. 2000 is when I started going on. But no, never a thought, never a desire. Never anything. It just kind of happened and it turned out to be my favorite thing.
Yeah. I mean, you're so incredibly like fast and witty on the radio. And I remember when started to do my, it's just true. But I remember when I started to do my podcast, I think it was Burr who goes, watch what happens to your stand up by doing a podcast. And I'm like, really? You know? And I did notice that you work a muscle. Like when you're alone talking, because a lot of times I did it alone. Now that it's on video, I have guests. But a lot of times I would do it alone. I would just talk, hey, guys, thanks for coming out and seeing me at this and blah, 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 do something. And I did notice that when I'd be on stage, I was like, oh, wow, I was never able to do that before doing the podcast. So radio has probably sharpened would you say it sharpened your stand-up?
Yeah, it makes you think about a lot of things that you might not normally think about. Like, you know, all the things in the news or what's happening with people getting in trouble or just shit that you talk about every day, you know, because you got to fill hours. So your mind, you know, what was really good for me was Tough Crowd because you had to write topically. So like Tough Crowd, after we got kicked off in 2002, I was starting to close rooms and I was like, you know, doing theaters because of Opie and Anthony. And then that went away. And then Tough Crowd forced me to be a better writer because you had to write. You know, you were on with Nick and you know, guys like Patrice or Bill or all these fucking killer funny dudes, Geraldo. And if you didn't have good jokes, you were going to get murdered. So that, after ONA, forced me to write better. So then when I went back on the road and when the radio started, I was a better writer. So yeah, A Tough Crowd did a lot of that for me too.
Yeah, the topical stuff you were able to. Yeah, no, that's, you know, you mentioned depression and we weren't like, you know, the funny thing is I always thought you were funny. And I was like, and I would say like, dude, you're one of my favorites. And I'd be like, I always thought you didn't like me in a weird way. I was like, I don't know if Jim likes me. And I'd be like, why? And I would talk to Bobby and I go, Bobby, I said something like being this dumb, insecure. Like I saw Jim at the stand. I'm talking like years ago, like 7, 8 years ago. And he'd be like, no, Jim is just a private. And I'll be like, you know, I said he was funny and I hope, but you mentioned depression. And I went through a really bad one in 16. Bad. Like, I didn't think I was coming out of it.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned before that you go through bouts of that. And I was reading this book on Dangerfield, and Dangerfield said something like his wife was like, he'd be in a room for months. And I remember reading it going, months? Like, how could somebody like that, right? Filled with life and filled with these funny jokes and just everybody wants to be around. And you're like, he's depressed in his room for months.
Did you realize he just hated his wife? It was her problem. She was the problem.
He was fine. He was just watching movies. Just yeah. The doors
cheating on her, fucking other women.
I'm a mess. He's just like,
I'm in a ball.
Yeah, put Godfather 2 in. I'm a mess, sweetie. No, so I had like this, it was like a clinical, like 12-week, couldn't get out of bed, convinced I was dying. I was getting all these tests. I thought I had a muscular thing. I thought I had a brain tumor. And it was like to the point where, because I didn't understand it. And it was like the darkest place ever. And I know that you had mentioned stuff before about being depressed and stuff. And do you have a coping, like, is your depression something that you just kind of, because a lot of people reach out and go, man, I'm glad you talked about that because I was suffering from it and what to do, what can I do? One guy was like, I've been in this for years. And I'm going, dude, if you're going through years, what I went through for 3 months and you didn't put a gun in your fucking mouth, then you're struggling. Do you just cope with it, Jim? Like, do you go to therapy and have medicine, or like, I mean, if you don't mind me asking.
Oh, I don't care. No, no.
But is it something that like on like when you feel it creeping up, you kind of just try to get in front of it and you know it's coming, or is it just something that you can't control?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry if I did, because I've had a few comedians tell me that they thought I didn't like them. And I realized it was like Sam Murillo and guys who I actually really liked and I think are very funny. But it was my own like thinking like, nah, they don't want to talk to me. Like, it wasn't an aloofness. It was feeling like, well, I'm just going to bother them if I sit down. Like, I have nothing to say. Like, right. They're not interested in me. But it was completely in feeling like I have nothing to offer. But yeah, the depression when it comes is nowhere near as bad as it used to be. But it's weird. It's like a chemical. I always equated it to like, it almost feels like a menthol has been dumped in your head. And you can feel it coming down and into your chest. It's a wow. Physical feeling, like a smoke or a menthol in you. Wow. Like it's a very physical feeling. And there's been times where I was just a disaster, just standing in the living room. There was a couple summers ago. I was just on my outside on my terrace every night, just thinking like, you got to jump. But it wasn't something you tell people. Like I never told people. I didn't want the group hug. Wow. It wasn't like right. I wanted people to rescue me. It was right. It was this very genuine feeling of like there is just nothing. It's just black. There's nothing. And there was nothing I wanted. Like I didn't want anybody to say something particular to me. So what I did, which was not good, is I just soaked in it and figured it would go away. But I am in therapy and I've been going to therapy for the last couple of years. Actually, funny, today's Tuesday. I had my therapist an hour ago. At from 1 to 2 on Tuesdays, I usually will talk to him. Now I'm doing Zoom sessions, and he's very good. And I don't feel as bad as I used to. I feel much better. But yeah, man, I still go through it. I'm not good at reaching out to people at all because again, I it's not an ego thing, but I don't want people to think that I want everyone to are you okay? Like that. I don't want that to be that needy to be.
You're not looking for sympathy with
it. No, no.
Right. So, dude, you got to the point where, like, you were standing on the edge of a terrace and just, like, questioning doing it? Really?
On a terrace. No, I mean, I wasn't over the edge. I was just standing on the, like, you know what I mean? Not like I wasn't leaning over. I was just standing on the terrace.
Right.
I kept envisioning, do I call down and do I tell them to make sure nobody walks outside for a minute? Like, I would walk through it in my head. And go, if you do this, you don't want to land on somebody. And I don't know if it was something I was actually thinking of, I'm going to do this, or was it just an exercise, walking through it? Like, was it just an exercise? I don't know what it was, but I know it was always in these just miserable, miserable times. I was going home after the cellar every night, eating outside and just sitting there and just contemplating these terrible, terrible things. But I wasn't.
By the way, you're the most considerate suicidal person ever. Because if I was going to do it, I would have just fucking been like, if I hit somebody, I hit somebody.
Well, I'm afraid of heights too. So there's that. Yeah. Like, I don't think I could ever jump. And that's why I think it might have just been an exercise. But I would try to walk through it logically and go, how would I do this? If I jumped and saw somebody, I would feel hard. Like, you know, it's just,
right.
What would I do? Knowing that I wasn't going to, like, again, that's why I didn't tell people, because I didn't want people to come over and go, hey man, we're here.
Yeah.
It was just my own thing. It was my own problem and my own, and you get comfortable with it. You get really comfortable with that drug release you get, whether it's that I'm in pain hormone or that fucking healing hormone, whatever gets released in your brain, you get used to. So a part of me was like, no, because if you tell people, then that won't happen anymore. And I kind of, part of me wanted to stay in that place. And didn't want people to know. And I didn't want people checking up on me.
Wow. And you're the first person that I've ever talked to about depression that said they actually felt something physically. Like they actually, like you said, I definitely, when I was on stage and I would get dizzy on stage and I thought something, I did have tightness, but you're saying that you actually felt like a menthol-y.
It's the best way I can describe it. Like it's a feeling it was in my head and in my upper chest. And I always think like, it's these weird chemicals that your brain must dump. And I don't know what it is. I mean, again, it's menthol is just the image I'm grabbing for it. Like, but it would be a physical. I knew a guy, I knew him from a 12-step program, and he was a mental health expert. He was a speaker, a very well-known speaker. He actually hung himself, but he was very big on mental health. And he said, I heard him say one time, mental illness is a physical illness. And I always remember that. I'm like, what a smart thing to say, because you look at mental problems like it's this far off at a distance thing. But no, it's all things that are physically firing, chemicals that are physically being released. It is a physical thing. It's not something that's in the air. It's a physical thing. So maybe that's why I felt it that way. I don't know.
It's kind of fucked up, though, when a guy dedicates his life to that and then hangs himself.
Yep.
It's like he fought the fight and then said, fuck, that's brutal.
And knew more about it and didn't. It also shows you how irrational that type of shit is. Like, you can't rational your way out of it. Like, whatever it is, I don't know exactly what his demons were. I just remember getting the call, but I don't remember. I don't know what was happening right before he did it. But it's one of those things where there's no way to. I guess you can't fix it by thinking in a way or by knowledge is no defense.
Yeah. No, dude, this is great, dude. Thank you so much for being on here, because you're somebody that I didn't get a chance to talk to a lot, which is good, because now when I talk to you, I'm learning, like, cause I think, I mean, I love watching you work and stuff. Were you, when you were coming up, you're a Jersey dude, right?
I am. Yeah. By the way, this is why people, I am not good on comedy podcasts, because literally it ends with, and my friend hung himself a while ago, but all right, listen, hey, thanks a lot. This was great.
Oh no. Here's the funny thing. When I said, I love having you on here, we're still doing a couple more. We're not done. Oh yeah. I wasn't going to wrap it up. No.
I get so annoyed at myself.
Yeah, I'm starting to get messages. Dude, should I just end it? No. So you were coming up in Jersey. Did you who were the guys you were looking at? Like when you first started, who were your heroes? I know that's a weird question, but we all have them.
No, it's funny. This morning on the radio show, I had Jim Florentine on, who I met him. I started in April of 1990, and I met Jim probably May of 1990, or, you know, within the first 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
So guys like Jim were one of the first guys I ever did gigs with, or Bob Levy, who's in Jersey. And Bobby would go up and do really filthy crowd work. It was lightning fast and ruthless. And these were tough rooms. And Bobby would fucking murder on stage. I loved Otto and George. There was a lot of local guys in Jersey who were headlining these rooms. And this before I met guys like Colin or Louie or other established headliners. First 5 years, I didn't go to New York at all. It was all Jersey and road gigs. So a lot of these local guys in Jersey were the guys I looked up to.
Wow. And then I know that you and Jim were big Dice fans, right?
Yeah, we, you know, it's funny. I remember the day the laughter died. was, which is so great. Dice is bombing at Dangerfields. He walked in the height of his fame and did a 3-hour. It was a double record set of him eating his dick at Dangerfields. It was great. Zero preparation, a couple of ideas. And that album, I loved that album. Like, I remember the first time I heard it, who I was with in the car with my buddy Scott. So me and Florentine over the years would bond over this obsession with this Day the Laughter Died album, part 1 and 2. And the night I met Dice, which changed my life in 97, I was with Jim in LA. And it was weird, you know, it's all this weird shit. But Dice changed my life. Dice is where most of it started for me.
Wow, yeah. And I remember that he said something like, didn't Dice make you and Florentine go on stage and recite it? Like, Jim told me a story or something where you guys would say, he goes, go do that. Go do it. Is that?
Yes, it was at the store. I was at the comedy. We were doing the Louis Anderson show. And there was four of us sharing a room at the Wyndham Bellage, which is now the London Hotel. Me, Rich Franchese, Jim, and Lenny Marcus were all sharing a hotel room doing the Louis Anderson show in Santa Monica. So I had to do a 7-minute clean set. So Maureen, my manager at the time, got me a set at the comedy store. So I walk on and fucking Dice walks in and goes on and does an hour. And he's a pig. He's a fucking pig for an hour. And he's killing. And you know, at the comedy store, it's the act brings you on. And Frankie Pace nobody wanted to follow him. So I'm like, I'll go on. Because I had a set schedule, but I'm like, I'll go next. Yeah. I knew I'd bomb, but I'm like, just to have Dice introduce me. And yeah, he gave me a shit intro. Hey, he's really great. What's his name? It was a fucking awful.
Yeah.
Missed an intro and I bombed. Yeah. And when I came off, him and Jim were talking because I had held up the payphone when Dice was on stage. And I'm like, Jim, guess who's here? And I held it up and Dice was on. So Jim came down. We start talking to Dice about this Day the Laughter Died and how ridiculous the jokes were. Like, what does that mean? I'd eat her cunt in a big red chair. Why would you? That's a terrible, like, we were teasing him in a way, but haven't, like, he knew we loved.
Yeah.
We were pointing out the things about these records that he loved, which right, is how crazy they are and how non sequiturs, they made no sense.
Yeah.
But Dice takes us in the back room and has us jot down things. He goes, I want you guys to go up as Jim and Jim. And I literally still have these papers. I found them recently that I was jotting jokes. I have data left.
That's fucking great, dude.
I have the tape of that night too, which I haven't heard in probably over 20 years. I have a cassette of Jim and Jim on stage. I should play that on the radio one time.
Oh, dude, that's epic.
Yeah, we bombed. I had already bombed, and now I was bombing with Jim. It was huge. I'm wearing a Lakers jacket, little pandering fruit, trying to get the LA crowd to like me. Dude, it was fucking disgusting. I bombed horribly twice that night, but Dice and I, he called our hotel room the next two nights later. We talked to Patty Ross, I think her name was, and she was a warm up for Louis Anderson's show. And we were like, we met Dice. It was fucking great. And she goes, Andrew's one of my best friends. And she told him about how we were bragging about meeting him. And he called at the hotel, woke us up, and took us shopping for furniture. Took me into furniture shopping with him.
Oh my. And you've been friends ever since.
Dude, that was 1997. And as we were leaving, Dice, like, how do I get a hold of you? And there was no cell phones. I don't think do we have cell phones? They existed, but I don't know if we had them. I had a business card on me. And I just handed him a business card. That was all I had with my number on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have a cell phone that yet. And Dice called me one night. Left me a message about his new show, Hits. And that was how it really started.
Oh, dude, that's such a fucking great story, man. And the fact that you and Jim, like, listened to that album, that double set album. And he, you know, I wonder, did you ever ask him, like, did you ask him this? Obviously, he knew he was bombing for 3 hours at Dangerfields, but was there ever a point where he was like, I'm just going, like, I don't care if this is enough? Was it like a defiance bomb where he's going to hold them hostage, or was it like,
he didn't care. Like, and Kenny, by the way, as you know, Club Soda Kenny was there.
Love, Kenny. It's a dear friend now. Yeah.
Kenny was there for those shows. So Kenny knows these stories because he went in with them. And he knew he was bombing. I guess he was working on material, just doing what you would do on a late night set. He wasn't announced, so the people didn't know that he was coming. They knew who he was. But he was just being such a pig. in front of these people. And it was so great because he got to walk out. A couple of people heckled. Like, they just had enough of his shenanigans. It was like a week before Christmas. They went in for a nice time. And then he's up there just talking about slipping in loads. And they were fucking disgusted. So, yeah, you listen to those. And it was defiant, but he didn't get angry at the crowd unless he was dealing one-on-one with somebody.
Yeah.
He didn't give a shit. Like, he was just talking to all the girls like he was going to fuck them. And he was just being belligerent, but he didn't seem angry.
Is anything funnier? This is my favorite that I've seen lose it on a crowd. Is anything funnier than when DePaulo is on stage and he's upset with audience members? It might be one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
It's so funny too, because I would work with Nick a lot at the Cellar, which is, you know, right in the heart of NYU in the Village, in the city. And so Nick would be on and he would do some joke, like a brutal joke about Hillary Clinton, that even Republicans would go, oh, and like one little liberal arts student would go, oh, hey, you fucking, and he would snap at the whole, but God damn, was he funny. And the joke was like, even the joke that made the girl groan was hilarious. Like, no one can deny how funny Nick DePaulo is.
You know what? I'm so glad you said that, because the next thing I was going to say was that he's the only guy that I've seen. He was at the Stand once and he goes, I don't know why I come to this fucking city, you liberal. And he's just saying everything and it's dead quiet. And then the next bit, he gets an applause. And it's like, that's how good of a comic and how good. But I remember he saw specifically these two women on the phone and he could not handle it. And you could tell there wasn't fun with it. It was like, it was definitely evil.
Yeah. Well, Nick, you know, Nick, you always know where you stand with Nick, as an audience member. But the jokes are so fucking good. Like, they're always funny. They're always new. And even his off the cuff, like, throwaway lines are great, great fucking jokes. He's one of the best comedy writers I've ever seen. And you watch him and it depresses you. It's like, cause the jokes are so well written. The structure is so good. And the punchlines are so fucking on. And he's a great comic.
How many guys can have audience members hate them and still clap? That's really, like, I was looking, I mean, I'm talking about, he had silence and people were angry and then clapped, and I'm going, dude, that's just, like you said, that's just the brilliance of the bit.
Just a great, a great joke. I would always love when they didn't. Attell was always funny when he bombed too, though. Even though Dave wouldn't necessarily get angry at them, you know, he would just go further into the fucking pit, like whatever it was that was bothering them. Yeah. I guess he knew this is a wrap and he was just kind of, you know, go down and enjoying himself. And he was always very funny to watch bomb too.
Yeah. Now, one of the funniest things I ever saw was one of my friends was on stage at the Stand, bombed, said a joke that bombed so bad. And then he just goes, no, but I like you guys. What's going on back there? Yeah. And he pointed to a dark corner. He goes, no, but I like you guys. What's going on back there? It was one of the most, watching your friend squirm.
Yeah.
It's really fucking funny, man. What room do you find the hardest in the city, would you say?
Comic Strip for me was always, maybe because I didn't feel welcome there.
Okay.
Because Lucian was never really that nice to me. I would always bomb in this, like, I don't care. Saturday
you said Comic Strip
show.
Real fast.
Immediately, if you ask me that, I'm like, if I have Alzheimer's and you say, where do you bomb the most? I would blurt out Strip. One of those two words would come out.
Yeah.
Whenever I had to do, at one point I was doing a decent amount of Tonight shows. And you go out, you do your warm-up sets. I would always want to do the Strip because I knew I would bomb. And I wasn't trying to bomb. But it was like, I always had this thing where you got to get it out of your system. And like, if you have a bad set, I'd never bother me to bomb before a TV taping. Cause I'm like, it was like a thing,
cleansing.
A cleansing in a way. And sometimes it would happen at the Improv in LA the night before, but it would always happen at the Strip. And at times it was frustrating because the room was good, but I don't think I ever had a great set there.
Wow.
No, never. The Comic Strip for me has never been a great room.
Wow. I wonder if things like that are in your head too.
Yeah.
You know, because you go in uncomfortable already. So like there's not really much confidence going in when a room constantly does that. Maybe.
I think you're right. Yeah, you always feel like, they kind of fucking, because the cellar is a harder room because the distractions you have of people walking back and forth to the bathroom, it's small. I mean, you know, and there's such a cross section of people. Dangerfields could also be really hard. You know, but I also had great nights there too. The Strip, I just never had fucking great nights at. So many rooms on the road I bombed in, but that in the city was the most consistent shithole for me.
Yeah, before when you said like the cellar at the beginning, because you're just wondering if once you get in there, you're just wondering if they're going to like you, if they're watching, you know, you want to feel like, you know, validated that they picked you and stuff like that. I remember feeling like that at the cellar. When I first got in, I would be like, but did you notice this? I noticed it in the city and especially at the cellar, is that the crowd, the sensitivity of the crowd. You know, when I did this, doing this WNBA joke in my new hour, and women just arms crossed, angry. And I just noticed a big change there. But then hearing comedians come in and going, dude, what's going on with New York? And I'm like, is this really? And I noticed a definite from like being in, I probably started working New York City gym, like as far as regularly, probably from like 07, 08 is like when I was really kind of moving around like club to club. And then I would say around like 11 or 12, I got in some places. The cellar was the last one, maybe a couple years ago. I was doing the stand for years and I didn't audition at the cellar, but I noticed a change in New York City for the worst. I see a really bad pullback, and going to Utah, going to Arizona, going to all of these places, Hilarities in Cleveland with Nick and all these places. And you're going like, it seems like they're here more for the comedy, where in New York, and I hate to say this about my own city. I hate to say it about the city that I grew, because I love it. But I do feel like sad when you say something and it's like what you saw. It's like, oh, no. Oh, and I'm going like, it's the first time in my career where the political divide is really kind of showing up in places that it shouldn't. Do you get that sense or no?
All the time. And I think there's a couple reasons for it. Like, you know, and it's funny, I mentioned the Strip and I said the Strip's a shithole. And I want to clarify that, not to be polite, but because I'm not blaming the Strip. It was like, even when the show was on fire, I would bomb. Like, you know what I mean? So I'm probably never going to work there again, but it was me. Like, it wasn't the room being bad. Like, everyone was killing and I would go up and fucking tank. I think that New York is suffering from that, maybe because these are showcase clubs and no one is there to see me in particular. Like, I get spoiled on the road. They're Jim Norton crowds, so they know what I'm doing. But in the city, you're just kind of going on.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And you're also the cross section, black, white, Indian, women, men, young, liberal. Like, there's everything packed into the room. Whereas you don't seem to have that as much in Utah or Philly or Cleveland. You might not have as many different groups. Like, everyone's laughing in New York and looking at who's at the next table. And maybe you don't have that as much in other places. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's the only thing. But yeah, you're right. New York is beginning to stink to do jokes in.
And somebody was like, oh, New York and LA. I went out to the Comedy Store. I got to go out there right before the lockdown and I had a great time. I did the Comedy Store. I did the Laugh Factory and it was cool out there. And I just said, wow, New York is a little uptight, but look, you could listen. We don't have to get political here, but one thing that it's like, remember when Democrats and Republicans would have a beer and just be like, you're out of your mind. Ah, fuck you. You're out of your mind. Let's go to the movies. Now that line in the sand, it's kind of gone over to even comedy clubs. I feel like now it's like, wait a minute, is he or she, you know, are they Republican? I had somebody actually, I was just talking about Trump in a way where I wasn't calling him Hitler.
Yeah.
And I just said something and somebody goes, wait a minute, are you a Trump? I swear to God, I'm not joking. They just go, Jim, they leaned in like, are you a Trumpster? And I go, first of all, I go, I'm an independent. I go, I don't fucking, you know, I go, I'm not voting for Trump or Joe Biden. Okay. But I do just said something, which wasn't that the guy was Hitler. And I just kind of asked a question and it was like, whoa, 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 Paul, the guy. And I'm just going, oh, that's what this is. So we can't even talk about anything you know, that has to do with this without there being a line and I'm either crazy or you're crazy and it's a fucked up thing. I see that in comedy clubs now, which really sucks.
Yeah, it's a microcosm of what the whole fucking dumb country is. Everybody blames Trump or they blame Kamala, whoever they blame, it's us. It's the people. It's not the people in charge. It's the dumb citizens. Because I did Trump jokes, but people would always, Trump people supporters would always say to me, like, I like the fact that you joke about it, but you're not coming from the same point of view. Like, I made a conscious effort to not come from the same predictable point of view as every fucking cornball. Not that hating Trump is corny, but when every late night host is doing the exact same angle, I'm like, fuck you. Like, have a different point of view just for comedic sense. You're not changing the world.
Well, that's why when, like, Alyssa Milano was like, the fact that more people listen to Joe Rogan than me, God help us. And I'm going, and I like, Alyssa, people know exactly what they're getting when they go to your show. There's never going to be another angle. There's never going to be you not saying the same shit. So, and the whole thing is like a guy like Rogan, even Bill Maher, who's definitely left. Even that guy will go, guys, this is getting a little, it's getting a little fucking wild.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, of course, I think Trump is fucking, you know, his rhetoric and he's a narcissist. And you know, and I think on the other side, I think the far left and the far right are both, you know, but I just can't believe that, like, you can't even speak normally. And you would think, Jim, that going into a comedy club is where that's all left at the door. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to hear some stuff. We're going to hear some stuff about drugs. You probably know somebody that overdosed. You're going to hear something about, you know, depression. You're going to hear something about abuse. But it's a joke. And the fact that it's not happening and the fact that it's happening in New York City, I literally get anxious about going into bits now in the city where I'm going like, oh, man, you know, can I say this? You know, can I say this? You know, I was doing this joke about like George Floyd, how like these protesters won't protest in the snow and they won't protest when it's cold. It's always 86. And I go, if they killed George Floyd in January, the Gucci store on Fifth Avenue would still exist, you know? And people, and I just going into it, I can just, and I'm just like, but it's not about, it's actually, I'm saying God bless George Floyd. That was horrible. I'm just saying that these protesters, it's convenient when they protest, but you go into something like that and people are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And it's like, are you listening to the joke? I'm joking about how protesters aren't all for the cause. That's what the joke is.
Because they're lazy and stupid. That's what it is. It's lazy thinking by people. Like, and you know, it was funny with when I would do Trump jokes. I loved, especially in the city, doing jokes and walking them through a thought where I was pointing out that I thought he was just like all the other politicians, no different. Like, he's not this separate. He's the same as that. And I loved roping them in. Like, the feeling of getting them to laugh, and like when you're not attacking him. He's the president. I mean, he deserves to be made fun of. He's the fucking president. I mean, you know. But when it wasn't the angle that they thought, that's always a satisfying, is figuring out how to get that thought across, like how to do a joke about, you know, the George Floyd protesters, because you already know people in the crowd, as soon as you say George Floyd, you're but it's not even true. I mean, they're not being honest. They're just, I feel like the whole country is in a play. Like, everyone is, we're all doing a giant 300 million person play.
Yes.
With this, no one being honest. No one is talking about how everyone's talking about things like they're, ladies and gentlemen, this is my private life and this is how I feel. We're all just putting on a show, according to how we think people are going to react to it. You know what I mean?
No, I actually don't think you could have said it better. I think that's exactly what's going on. I think it's all fake. I think a lot of it is just false energy that people just want you to think a certain thing. And it's like, if you listen to that joke and you just hear George Floyd, protesters, Gucci stores still exist, you're not listening to me. And nothing I said in that joke was anti-George Floyd, anti-anything. I was just saying that half of these protesters that don't know what the fuck they're even doing out there are full of shit.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's what it is too. No, dude, this is such a great conversation. There was one more thing that I wanted to talk to you about. It was that, oh no, I think we got to that. Do you have anything coming up that you want to plug, or are you going to be on the road?
No, I go back out, I think, probably in March or April. Because
I love how I'm asking you that during a pandemic where nobody's working. So what's that tour looking like?
Yeah, but you know, for me, it's like looking pretty normal. You know what I mean? Like, you know, fucking half-empty rooms, 40% take. We can only do 20%. Great. Great. That's great news for me. I think March or April I'll go back out. But I've been hesitant. I rebooked them once. And then, like, you don't know how long are things going to be open. What percentage are they going to let? It's just too unsure. And yeah. I don't want to keep fucking booking airfare and booking hotel and all of a sudden changing them. So, you know, I'm thinking March or April.
Oh, that's one thing. Did you ever meet Trump?
Yes, I've met him.
I did the Tonight Show
with him. I met him once at his roast very briefly. And we took a photo. And then I did the Tonight Show with him once and just chatted briefly. But Don Jr., I'm friendly with him because he used to live in the right above me in the city. He lived on the floor above me, so we got to know each other. And I like Don Jr. a lot. Like, he's a, you know, and people get mad every time he's on our radio show and I don't attack him. I'm like, well, I'm friends with him. I'm not gonna bash the guy just to make you fuck. I like him, you know. Like, it's crazy how if you don't attack somebody that people don't like.
Well, that's the other thing. That's like the hypocrisy. It's now like, don't become what you hate. You know, don't become what you hate. And it's kind of funny that now I saw something now that said, if you're an employer and you have Trump supporters working there, you need to find them and fire them. And I'm going like what? Like, not everybody that likes Biden is a socialist who hates America. And not everybody that, you know, likes Trump or likes Trump's posse is a racist bigot. But like, lose your job. Lose your fucking job. Like, I heard somebody was like, we're going to find them. We're going to leave no stone unturned. What does that mean?
It's fun to watch it though. Like,
yeah.
When you know what it is, when you know that it's just, it's really a country of narcissists. We're narcissists and nobody wants to be proven wrong. And that's all it is. Right. And the way I say it is like, when you watch CNN or Fox or any of these fucking, watch the talking heads. When is the last time any one of them on any network goes, fuck, you're right. I didn't think of that. Good point. You're right.
Never.
Never. So either every one of them is a genius who's right, or we're a country of stubborn assholes who just don't want to ever admit that we're wrong. And every single thing that happens, there's no real events anymore. People take everything that happens and they use it as ammunition for the next argument. Like, no matter how tragic it is or how fucking nonsensical it is, people put it in their little pile of things to throw the next time they have a debate. And I've really backed off on watching it. And I make myself not tweet about it because I hate it so much when people do it. It's not impressive. I'm not impressed with their ferocity. Ooh, the knowledge. Shut it. It bores me. It's boring.
And the Twitter thing is all narcissists too. It's all, if you sit there and you write some big long thing, it's just because you think you have a brilliant thought. You think you're smarter than everybody else. And people are going to go to bed scratching their head going, wow, you know, that fucking so-and-so is brilliant. It's all, you know what it is? This is the perfect way to end this. You're 100% right. We're all narcissistic fucking lunatics. You're never going to have somebody go on Fox News or CNN and just go, you got me. Same thing with your relative. You're not going to sit with your relative at Thanksgiving that's so far right or far left and make them go, you know, I'm changing my vote. It's not going to fucking ever happen.
Never going to happen. And the whole country is screaming at each other through plexiglass. And all we really want is for someone to hear, to listen to us. Like, that's what everybody wants. It's for, like, you know, when you have an argument with somebody and they go, you're right. But we want that one moment where everybody just goes, thank you. That's how we needed to hear it. You're right.
Yeah.
That's all we want. And we're never going to get it. And instead of accepting that we're not going to get it, we just keep getting madder at each other and trying to say it better. And it's like, how about we just accept that other people don't always think? How about people accept the fact that some people are just anti-abortion and are always going to vote Republican? And the fact that they like Trump doesn't mean that they're any less than you, you fucking pompous asshole. Or how about you realize that everyone who likes Kamala Harris isn't a Fidel Castro commie? You know, it's crazy.
But I'm hoping that most people are like me and you, what we're saying now. I'm hoping that, like, the way me and you were speaking about it logically from both sides, hopefully that's the country. You know, because don't forget, 73 million people voted for Donald Trump, 77 million people voted for Biden. That's a split in half country. And I don't think there's 73 million racist bigots. And I don't think there's 77 million people that hate America and are socialists and want to lose freedom of speech.
Right. You're right. And Bill Maher, by the way, Bob, you mentioned, I love Bill Maher. Like, even when I don't agree with what he says politically.
He used to annoy his fucking face. Oh. I'm just going to be honest. His face and his arrogance and his fucking the way he would talk bothered me. But lately I'm seeing something in him that seems a little more like fair, or like at least like calling out far radical shit on both sides.
Yeah, he's always had that vibe. Like, people who don't like him, like, he seems very condescending. And in some ways he is. But he's never been a language cop. Like, he's never been a guy who tried to penalize people for saying things. Right. And that's all I ever ask for, is like that you don't penalize people for saying shit you don't like, or you don't try to get people fired for jokes or opinions you don't like. That's all. That's all. I like. And he's never done that. So I've always kind of liked him for that. He's never wanted people punished for thoughts that he thinks are stupid.
And you know, and I hate to keep you, but this is so great, dude. This is so great. You're the fucking best. And this is, I'm loving this conversation. And I know it's good because time's going. On the radio, whether it was you and Opie, whether it was, you know, you and Sam, and you're sitting there and somebody's coming in that you either just adamantly don't like, you don't like, or you don't like their view, or they did something. I get the sense that you guys, you do a good job of like not, because I'm trying to think of one where you got into it with somebody. It might have been Nancy Grace or somebody.
Yeah.
And was it Nancy Grace?
That was Sam and I's. I think that was our second show. It might have been our second or third show together. Yeah.
And you, so when you do have somebody that you just adamantly have a disagreement with, or like their behavior or rhetoric you don't like, you're always giving them the benefit of the doubt anyway. And that's kind of hard and doesn't happen enough now, because now it's almost like, you know, you ever see somebody go on The View that they don't like, or you see somebody go on a show and it's almost like, so, and it's just a, well, you kind of, I notice, is it hard to do that?
You know, it's more interesting. Like, Nancy Grace, I think she sucks. I don't like her because I thought she always capitalized, and I don't care how she phrases it. Tot mom hashtag is a fuck. You're capitalizing on a dead kid. Shut your face.
Right.
But she blocked me on Twitter. She's the only celebrity to block me because I would always bash her. But then she came into our show to promote a book, and we were talking to her. And I said at one point, "I'm look. I have to say, like, I didn't yell at her though, and I wasn't out to start a fight with her. But I felt like I'm a coward if I do it on my keyboard, but not in person. Like, if I don't say it to the person," and I wasn't going to go, "fuck you," now, I wasn't going to do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I felt like I had to say it because I've made it publicly known before. And I didn't want to be a complete coward about it. So it's not that hard, because typically in person, most of us are nicer than we expect. And I've met people who didn't like me, and they're like, "Yeah, you're nice. You were nicer than I thought." And I've had, dude, when ONA would do fucking Jocktober, where we would just attack radio shows every day of the month for October, who's the idiot that has to go out and plug gigs on the road? I walked into these places so many fucking, Opie and Anthony didn't have to deal with that shit. I did. Yeah. And I remember being in Boston, and I was going to do a morning show in Boston. And Kenny came in and goes, "The other show is one that you guys attacked on Jocktober, and they want you to come in." And I'm like, "Sure, I'll come in." And I walked into this. I don't even remember the show. And they're like, "Yeah, we had obviously bashed them pretty brutally on Jocktober." So I walked in and just hung out. And we got along fine. And I think I was nicer than they expected me to be. And they were fine, nicer than I thought they would be when I walked in. So most times in person, people are a little better than you expect.
You know, one thing that happens to me going on the road sometimes is my relationship with Pete Davidson. So I'll be on the fucking radio and these people will go, "Dude, what's up with your boy Pete, man? Is he," or like, "what's," and I just go like, I got to be honest, in fairness, it's only been a few radio stations, but it's like, first of all, dude, that's a dear friend of mine. And if you think I'm going to come on here and fucking shit on my friend because he's this big, you know, and he dated this pop star. And I just kind of looked at the guy and I go, "No, Pete's actually really dude, it was great." I disarmed. I go, "No, Pete's actually one of the most misunderstood, coolest kids ever." And the guy just goes, oh, and it was like, yeah, you fuck. I know what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
You're trying to fuck. You know what I mean? Like, let me plug my fucking dates in your shitty town this weekend and not talk about my dear friend. But yeah, that's what they try to do. And it is true about Pete. A lot of people have this, you know, Pete's a great example. He's a great kid. You know, he's a good kid. And people want to talk about like, oh, is he really whacked out? Is he in him? And it's just like, you don't know him. I don't want to mention this on the show, but there's some radio in the country that like they act like they're fucking high up and they do this and they give you rules and they're saying this and you get emails about don't do this. And it fucking stinks. It stinks. It's older radio. It's not. Yeah. That's why I love when the last time I was on with you and Sam, it's just normal fucking. I'm not saying that just because you're here, because you never book me again. I don't give a fuck. I'm sitting here just saying like, when you sit and you talk with somebody that it's like this, where then there's rules and it's about them. Because don't you feel like some radio guys are great.
Yeah.
Like the guy like DVR in Pittsburgh. Some of these guys are fucking awesome. But then
Randy, he's awesome.
Randy's
Randy's
great. You know, and there's good guys in Atlanta. There's good guys in certain places where Arizona, I had a good time. But then there's some places where it's like, oh, this is our home. And you feel that when you walk in. It's almost like, where's the funny man? This is, and like, they're just not setting you up right. And you're going, oh, okay, I know what this is. This isn't about getting people in the show. This is not about that. And that's a real shitty thing, I think.
You know, it's funny. I did deal with that. It's been a long time. I remember one time in Sacramento or something, I was dealing with a guy who was a real dick, local radio guy, resented the comedians coming in. But I think once O&A started again, I think I got less of that because they knew I was on the radio and they knew the reputation of the Opie and Anthony show and audience. So most of them were fine, because I think they didn't want to deal with the Opie and Anthony audience, who would, again, in Jocktober. But I'm sure it also cost me bookings too. Like, I'm sure there's certain shows that wouldn't have me on because of that. But I think when I went on, I got lucky in that respect where once the show came back on satellite, I didn't have to. Most of the time the guys would ask me, what's satellite radio like? They wanted to know more. Like, they more wanted to get information out of what is satellite like than shit on it. You know, like, even off the air, 2006, 2007, they'd be like, is that a good place to go? Because everyone was afraid of getting fired at that point.
Yeah. Dude, Jim, this has been so great, dude. Like, I could talk
thank
to you,
you
forever. It's no, dude. Thank
this
you, man.
Fun.
Really. Thank you, man. The show just flew by and it's because of the great guest that you are. And
thank
this
you.
Was so awesome. Guys, you know where to see him. Check him out. Jim and Sam on Sirius XM, his amazing specials. Man, check him out. This has been the Verzi Effect, 472. Hope you guys enjoyed it. You could get it on Spotify, iTunes, everywhere you get your podcasts. And until next week, I am out of here. Dude, thank you so much, man.
Of course, man. I was happy
to.
It was
the shit you were saying. I could tell people are going to be like, oh, that was fucking great.
Oh,
it
cool.
Was,
thanks.
It was really great. Now, by any chance, do you know something that you've predicted before? It could be when you were younger or it could be anything, but you were like, I fucking knew that shit would happen.
Let me think. I mean, a specific.
Yeah, like just if there was something where you were like, dude, I knew, you know.
You know, the only thing I can, but no, that doesn't even, I would have to think about that.
Yeah, well, you know, we could do it in the future, dude. It's a 10-minute thing.
I would like to do it, but I want to have a real answer for you. Because the thing thinking of isn't, it was just about how people getting in trouble and how that was not going to change. But that's too vague. There have been things. Let me think about that because I do want to do it, but I want to do it honestly.
No. Absolutely. Like I said, dude, it's like 7 to 10 minutes. We could do it in the future. Like it would be something that you know that you predicted and then you just make a future prediction and then we kind of hold it. Like we'll just like either revisit it or like it's on record and it's got a YouTube page and we've had some cool guests. But
what's an example of something someone's predicted? Like I want to just the type of thing, like was it a victory or like what is an example?
Yeah. So it could be, so I'm just trying to think of one that like, so some people did some sports ones. Some people did one where like Tim Dillon was like, I don't think you're going to, this was early on though. So now it looks kind of easy, but early on, Tim Dillon's like, I don't think you're going to be able to, his future prediction was, I don't think you're going to be able to go to any event without getting your temperature taken. But he said that like like early, like March. And then, you know, and then people like something that people would predict is they said, like, I knew either something politically was going to happen, or I knew this was going to or a terror attack, or I had a feeling about, like, so any kind of like, or it could be, I fucking knew Troy Aikman was going to be with a hooker that year. I knew he was playing like shit. So it could be like anything. That's the beauty of it. Anything that you want. One guy, the guy on Barstool, KFC,
yeah.
He said something where he's like, the Mets owner, that Steve Cohen, when it dropped out, he goes, it's coming back, and he's going to – so he kind of like for season one, he kind of had that. He was like, I know it looks like the Wilpons are going to stay, but you know what? The other one's going to come back. It's going to come back into it. Jerry Ferrara, he said before – this was a crazy one. He almost got it right. I don't know how the fuck he almost got this right. Jerry Ferrara goes, I'm telling you right now, everybody is saying the Lakers and Clippers. He goes, the Miami Heat are going to win the NBA title. And I'm going like, what? They got to play the Bucks, and they got to – game six of the finals when nobody had him. And he's like, no, I watch a lot. So that was one that would have been like, nobody would have had that. So it's just like, it's just fun shit like that. Burr predicted, what did Burr predict? Burr predicted something, some fucking New England Patriots thing. I don't know. But yeah, man, whatever. I'll just, you know, we could.
Yeah. I want to think of something specific. Cause again, predicting that things were only going to get worse with people getting in trouble for what they said, that's too vague. I want to think of something specific, and I want to give you an honest answer. So yeah, I would definitely will do it.
Yeah. No, dude, whenever, like we'll be in touch in the future, dude. This podcast was great. And, dude, wish you well during all this nonsense too,
you
man.
Too, buddy.
It's going to be, months and shit, but hopefully, we'll talk soon. All right.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah. Come on the morning show whenever you want. We love you. So anytime you want.
I'd love to. You guys are the best. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, Paul. Take care.